Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 62 of the Footmarks podcast. I'm your host, Behram Kazi, who you can find at Def Mango on Twitter. And with me, as always, is Jared Kimber. Still in the flesh, which is our last podcast.
This is our last flesh.
Yes, it is. It is our last flesh. And the title of this podcast is Overthrowing Cricket's Empire. Might as well just go with the name of your book because we're going to be discussing it in this one. How does it feel, Jared, to actually have it in front of you over here in print?
Yeah, it's one of those things that I must have... I don't know how many books I've written. I should know that. Hmm. Maybe five or six. And so when you get them, there is that... It's really cool. You open a box and there's just so many of them. I think this is my first hardcover book.
Ooh.
So this one was a little... And I didn't know that it was hardcover until it turned up. So I was quite excited when this bad boy turned up. And enjoying it quite a lot. I would say I've tried very hard with my covers over the years, but with limited budget. Hmm. This is one of the few times when the cover has come out absolutely perfectly as I wanted. So it looks good.
It does.
And I'm very excited that it exists.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited to own a copy as well. I've gone through the first two chapters, but I have obviously discussed this book so much with you that we're going to talk about some general themes today. We're not going to give away too much because we want you to buy the book, right?
Buy the book.
Yeah. But, of course... It speaks of the empire, right? Overthrowing cricket's empire. And that is Great Britain, if you will, yep. I suppose. And the British Empire. And they obviously conquered most of the world, right? The sun never set on the British Empire. They were the colonial conquerors back in the day. Mm. And also, they used cricket as a tool to basically teach their subjects the way English life was supposed to be lived. Mm. And that's a major theme in your book, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that is, it's one of those things that I think this will annoy, I think this title will annoy some English fans. Mm. But I don't think they understand how much the empire actually impacted people from Pakistan,
yes,
and Canada and Australia and Sri Lanka, like, you know, my family's from. We all lived with the empire and it's all well and good for modern English people to be like, oh, there's no empire anymore. Yeah, we still have it. Yeah. We still have elements of it. We still have elements of it in our laws. I remember someone in the West Indies telling me once that they had a law about homosexuality. Mm. And he was like, I don't think that many people here actually care that much about that law, but it's a hangover from the English days now and it's still there. They affected every part of us. Yeah. And then cricket specifically was used as a game, especially, and I would say in the subcontinent more than anywhere else, but certainly in the subcontinent, as a way of teaching people proper values and morals. And we know that that's all kind of nonsense because these were people who were more than happy to cheat and get themselves paid more as amateurs all the time. But it was used as that sort of an artificial extra helping hand for the English at times when they were doing their conquering.
I don't think any other sport has had that sort of experience.
No.
Cricket is quite unique in that regard, right?
Yeah, they didn't do football that way, right?
Like absolutely not.
It was very specifically cricket. I don't think rugby, and rugby would be the other obvious one.
I mean, it was labeled the gentleman's game for a reason, right? And that was because they were trying to quote unquote civilize.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, proper cricket historians will say, well, the gentleman's game basically meant that means posh people owned it.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean all men, although in modern day everyone thinks all men, but it really wasn't. You know, I know people who are, you know, from the subcontinent and from other countries who are very happy to have been civilized.
Yeah.
Right. And, there are other people who feel very much the opposite of that.
I mean, people who are victims of the post-colonial hangover will be very, very happy that it was used that certain way.
Yeah.
And other people, not so much. So it goes both ways depending on where you're from and what you've, you know, experienced in your childhood and how you've been raised.
Also, and just, you know, there was probably a whole era of like, maybe I'm at the end of it. Hmm. But people over the age of 50 were taught about England very differently in schools than people in Pakistan and India and South Africa and New Zealand and Australia and Canada are now, right? So we have a very different experience of that sort of stuff. We are now taught the darkest side of things. We are now taught that, well, how could you be the first people to be in Australia when Australia had Indigenous people for 50,000 years, right?
Exactly.
And all those sorts of things we now question, which we didn't question as much 30 or 40 years ago. So this book, again, is re-examining, you know, those sorts of themes as well. But it is essentially a book about cricket as much as anything.
And it is also a book about English cricket and English cricketers. You've obviously spoken about some great English teams and some legendary English cricketers, but it's from a different lens. The perspective is far different from what you would find in another sort of book, which would be glorifying them.
Yeah, and I think in some ways, I don't want to lump into the I'm writing another cricket book about England because everyone writes cricket books about England. But I just thought this was the cricket book about England that hadn't been written, which is what happened on the other side. And, you know, I remember coming up with this idea. I was on a podcast with someone and it was just random. And this person was like, so hard to come up with ideas. And I was like, well, no one's ever written a book about all the times that teams beat England for the first time.
Yeah.
And then I went to myself, oh, wait a minute, and wrote that down on my little whiteboard. And you know, I think the next part of cricket history, there'll still be great guys writing about, you know, Yorkshire cricket and, you know, cricket in the leagues and all that sort of stuff. But the next part of cricket history is really, I think, opening up tales like this, which is, I look at this as the story of cricket told from the other side.
Exactly.
And I think that's a really important way of looking at this book.
And also, you focus a lot on the nation-building element of defeating England, your colonial conquerors. Of course, we'll get into other teams which weren't ever colonized. But cricket, for the most part, has been a Commonwealth sport up until recently, where you've got Afghanistan and the Netherlands and some other teams, right? Ireland is one. But, you know, throughout history, it was always colonial conquerors and the subjects who were like made to feel inferior throughout Britain's, you know, rule, because they definitely put themselves on a pedestal.
Mother country, right?
Yeah. And mother country, all of that stuff, certain train carriages in which only English people were allowed, certain bars or restaurants where only English people were allowed, dogs and Indians not allowed or something like that. You had that sort of signage, right? I grew up with these stories as well.
And also, like if you went to England, you weren't treated the same way.
Yeah.
You know, there was always an element of that sort of stuff. The first Indigenous team went to England and then the second team went over and they were white and they were called a racial slur based on what the first team was. Like, they weren't treated as equals.
And when you defeat England in an international cricket match for the very first time, there is identity building that comes with it.
Yeah.
You as a nation grow and that victory means more to you just because of the entire context with which cricket was used and the way that England, for the longest time, did see themselves on some sort of high horse.
So, you know, me and Abhishek were talking about this when I was trying to write the introduction chapter, because I had all the other chapters pretty much written. I think Afghanistan had to be rewritten after the podcast series. Sorry, because I hadn't beaten England. A few of the other chapters have been rewritten and added to and changed and quite a bit. But, you know, it was pretty much written. But the introduction chapter, I didn't really know what to do. And I remember thinking with Abhishek of like, why are we writing this book and we're not writing about beating Australia for the first time? We're like, it doesn't really matter when you beat Australia for the first time. It's important. And people go, yeah, we've beaten Australia. That's another step.
It's a more recent thing, isn't it?
It's more recent, but also it's not a, it doesn't change your national identity.
Yes.
It changes your cricket identity. And in this case, there are so many stories here where it actually changed the way that these countries looked at themselves.
Absolutely.
Like they were like, great, we're here now. Right? And I think that's a hugely different thing. And that's the reason this book exists, I think, really, is that there was something about that that I really realized. And we know Australia's been the best team in cricket history, and they've been better than England. We know the West Indies had an incredible flare-up, and beating India now is a hugely important thing.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't write a book about any of those.
Nope.
Whereas England is, it's so intrinsically built into the sport that even when you're not a Commonwealth country, there's something about beating England that you don't get from the other teams.
We'll come into that later, but I definitely agree that, you know, as far as nation building and coming up with your own identity is concerned, beating England in cricket is a major part of that, right? And someone from the subcontinent, which I am, and I think I speak
for... I thought you were Canadian.
Yeah, well, I'm also Canadian, which was also colonized.
Exactly.
Weirdly enough.
You're double colonized.
I have sworn oath to the Queen who has passed away, so now technically I'm back under the crown. But anyway, just from a subcontinent's perspective, and I think I'm quite sure that I speak for at least all Pakistanis, Indians, and Bangladeshis, right? Where this wasn't settler colonialism like in New Zealand or Australia, where you just wipe out the indigenous folk. The British the pre-British subcontinent had what? Very, very rich people in it.
Yeah.
It was responsible for around 25 to 30% of the GDP globally. Yeah. And it was where the money was at. And
a mature, you know, it was a mature, modern world in some ways.
Absolutely.
It wasn't Western.
No.
But it was, you know, like we saw with places like Iraq and China, right? Like, it just grew in a different way than the Western civilization did. But it was very mature and had deep roots.
Right before the English conquered the area, it was experiencing one of its more, you know, glorious periods. Even in terms of, like, religious harmony. There was a lot of like good stuff going on in certain Mughal empires. Not all of them. There were some really messed up ones as well. But there were some empires in between where everyone was really happy over there and there was a lot of money, right? Mm. And then the British came and they exploited the local population. It was a different kind of colonialism. And then they kind of, you know, had that master-servant sort of relationship. And I feel like that adds so much more baggage to the story that it makes you want to beat those masters more.
I don't think that England players, even to this day, fully understand it. Mm. And I don't know if the ECB do this, but if I was the ECB, I would do a history lesson.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't even about the Asian stuff, although everything you just said is 100%. Do you remember when, I think it was Colin Graves came in as the ECB chairman, and one of the first things he said was that he wanted them to go to four-day tests for certain teams.
Mm.
New Zealand spent 2 decades in test cricket trying to get 5-day tests.
Yeah. Right?
And they were treated like nobodies.
Mm.
When he said that, he didn't realize, he was actually talking about New Zealand's nation building. They had earned 5-day tests as a country is how they felt about it, right? And that's the chairman not knowing about that. And I've talked to English players and they're like, I don't know why these players get so fired up when I say this comment. And it's like, because you're English. And because they have lived under the thumb of that their whole lives, even when England left, they still have elements of it there.
Absolutely.
Every day. And so it is so different than anyone else. Yeah. And I don't think English people, because English people now don't live in that kind of world, right? They don't get it. And I understand them not getting it. That's why I think the history is quite important.
I mean, you read of all of these great tales from pre-England times within the subcontinent, and then you see that the British come in. First, it's just the East India Company. So it's a company ruling over the land, essentially. Yeah. The crown is not even involved, right? And then they grow their influence to a point where they are ruling the land. They are exploiting the local masses. Mm. They have them under their thumb, right? They make them feel inferior. And then they leave, giving them a post-colonial hangover plus inferiority complex. And when you defeat them...
And take their
them,
resources.
Yes, you plunder them to the T. You have the Kohinoor diamond and you take it away. And Bengal, which was one of the most, you know, wealthiest areas globally, you basically had an entire fleet taking stuff out from there. So you do all of that. You leave people with that hangover and inferiority complex. And then when you defeat that same England in a game of cricket, which is their sport, that means a hell of a lot more.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's a very important thing that, and, you know, something we tried to talk about, you know, all the way through the book is that this is not beating a normal cricket team.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a really, really important thing to remember. And that's why this exists.
Yeah, and let's go to Australia for a bit, right? Because they were the first team that defeated England. And back when they did that, Australia weren't even a nation, right? It was, what, 1878, if I'm not wrong, the first time they beat them? But that's not the important one. Of course, when they defeated them at the Oval against one of, you know, the better English teams that played them at that time. Because, as you know, cricket was run very differently or played very differently. It wasn't professionalized like it is today. A lot of cricketers, like W.G. Grace himself, preferred to be amateurs because they'd make more money that way.
Yeah.
And this wasn't an indigenous Australian team either. It was just a bunch of blokes who pooled in some money and to
it. Yeah, it wasn't like there was a selection committee or anything.
Yeah.
So but the thing about this was Australia's second tour.
Yes.
So there'd been an indigenous team first, which wasn't considered Australia. And then there'd been another Australian team that no one thought was good enough to play. But then they destroyed W.G. Grace specifically at Lord's. Fred Spofforth went through them. And then they went back to play this other one. And that was when England took them seriously and put up a strong side. And England still couldn't beat Australia. And that's really when the phrase Ashes comes along. That's when the poem or the whatever you want to call it.
Also, W.G. Grace participates in a run out that Johnny Bairstow would not like. We're not going to give you too much on that. Buy the book and read the story.
It is, it is worth mentioning, though, that when Grace did that, he didn't understand what nationalism meant. Right?
Did the Australian team understand that? Because Australia wasn't a nation.
They weren't, but they were. It wasn't a nation formally.
Yeah, but they were like, fuck the British.
Definitely. And I think there was an element of a lot of the Australian players in the first team were born in England.
Hmm.
As it was going on, these players were becoming Australian in what we now know what Australia is. And specifically, there was lots of Irish and Scottish players that you can see in the names that start to come through, right? I think they took it as that. And so it was changing. But also, they were being belittled by the empire through Grace.
Yeah.
Right? And Grace wouldn't have got that because he'd been bullying people his whole life.
Absolutely.
And it just happened to be that he, in this particular case, he bullied the wrong person. You know, Moyles and Spofforth were too good and they end up winning this incredible game. And it is one of the most fascinating games in Test match cricket history.
Yeah.
The fact that it was one of the early ones doesn't take away anything from that. The drama of that game is incredible. But that is the game that builds international cricket.
If you need your pitch changed, well, NordVPN can doctor any surface to a new location so that your IP address is set for you to win. Want to watch a game on a free stream in another hemisphere? Give NordVPN the ball. Or if you just want to watch a clip on social media that a cricket board won't allow, promote NordVPN to pinch hit. So if you need a VPN, go Nord. Use nordvpn.com/Kimber to get a 2-year contract with a discount, plus 4 extra months and gifts in some markets. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. The link is in the show notes. Protect your computer like a bowler protects the boundaries in the death overs with nordvpn.com/Kimber today.
Yeah, I mean, already we know that that group of Australian cricketers, they wanted to be anti-English. They wanted to defeat them. They had that motivation within them. But then the WG Grace run out of Sammy Jones definitely riled them on. Definitely riled Spofforth on.
I wonder if Australia lose that game because that was one of those things where it brought them all together as a team. So, yeah, and you know, you don't want to... In general, it's not good to antagonize the opposition's fast bowler.
Yeah.
You know,
also,
or two of them in this case.
We know that Australia is the most successful cricket team of all time. But that story starts somewhere, right?
Yeah.
This is where it starts. It's huge. The newspaper with the Ashes clipping, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the series before that, as I said, they didn't think Australia was good enough to play them with a proper full-strength team. So it goes from not being good enough to losing to them in a short period of time.
And England were bullish in that same way till quite a long time. You think of Sri Lanka, right? They didn't even play him that often until they got Murali'd at home.
I mean, the Sri Lanka one is one of the more fascinating ones. The actual game is not as fascinating as in the stories.
Hmm.
But the strategy of that game is bizarre because Arjuna Ranatunga turns up and decides to send England in because he only plans to bat once.
Hmm.
I cannot imagine, like, what sort of an arrogant... And he was right. They only did bat once.
Yeah.
And then they batted like Bazball and absolutely went for England. And you're right. It, you know, England was exhausted. England was coming on the back of the sixth test match.
Yeah.
They thought Sri Lanka was no problem. And this is after the World Cup victory.
Hmm.
I thought Sri Lanka would be no issue. And Murali basically bowls unstopped, all the way through the first innings, all the way through the second innings.
And he took a shit ton of wickets, didn't he?
Yeah, and, you know, he did that. How many wickets did he?
16.
He took 16 wickets, Eeks just told us in this test match. I don't know why Eeks part of this podcast. but, yeah, it's, you know, just absolutely crazy. So then you have, that is 1996.
Hmm.
And we're talking more than 100 years earlier. They were still weren't taking teams seriously.
Exactly.
So it does tell you that not that much has changed. So when we talk about the empire finishing and these countries becoming normal, England cricket didn't suddenly just decide once they started running Ceylon, right, that suddenly Sri Lanka was an equal, did they? These teams had to then win that in the form of battle, right?
It was basically a sort of badge of honor because they lose that Oval Test versus Australia, and now all of a sudden the Australia versus England fixture is huge, and that's where that rivalry starts. But go 100 years, or more than 100 years into the future, something similar is at play with Sri Lanka, where they're not taking them seriously at all. They lose to Sri Lanka at home.
At the Oval.
And a spinner is the one who kind of dismantles them, takes 16 out of 20 wickets. And then they start to take Sri Lanka seriously. So basically, up until you defeat England in a major game, you're not going to be taken seriously. And that is a theme that kind of is recurring throughout this history.
Yeah, and it's the one thing that I think there are some people that would say things like, well, Australia wouldn't play these teams at all. And that's because they didn't think they were good enough. And that's the right thing to do. Whereas England would play them with weaker sides.
Hmm.
And at least they played them. And I kind of, that argument makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Because at least you're still giving them good cricketers to go up against. Whereas Australia are like, you're not good enough. We're not going to play you. Which I just think is...
That is fair, yeah.
Why are you even doing that at that point? But at the same time, there's an element of disrespect with, New Zealand's first test match.
Hmm.
England send over a B team to play them. Because the A team is playing the West Indies on the same day.
Hmm.
You can't disrespect a team more than that.
That is true. And of course, you mentioned how New Zealand had to really earn 5-day cricket, right? And Colin Graves was very, very ignorant to that fact as well. But coming to the West Indies, of course, I haven't read that chapter yet, but I have watched Fire in Babylon. And
Ezekiel read that chapter. He's trying to get it on the podcast.
But that, you don't have to break my flow, bro.
We're trying to podcast.
Yeah.
You're the worst. Leave all this in here, shit. People need to know.
Now let's talk at the end of it, okay? No more. Please.
He's got a vibe.
Mm. But I have watched Fire in Babylon. Mm-hmm. And that, if you guys haven't watched it, this should be the first thing you do after watching this podcast. It's a must watch. It's on YouTube. After you read the book, you watch Fire in Babylon on YouTube. And you can just see how much it meant to that West Indian team to defeat England. That comment by Tony Greig, right? About grovel. How they will make them grovel. And the West Indies took that and they did the exact opposite. Flipped the coin or flipped a switch on England. And then England did not defeat them for what, 2 decades? 2.5 decades? Something like that. So a lot of that, because the West Indies isn't one country.
No.
It's a collection of different countries. But all of those, you know, cricketers got under that one banner. They asked everyone to rally around them. And they drew motivation from beating England.
They still beat England at home, don't they?
Yes.
So even in the last couple of years when they've been a dreadful side, they still find a way to beat England. And there's no doubt that they seem to play better cricket against England than everyone else. Some of that's got to be matchup.
Hmm.
But you talk to the West Indian players and they will tell you, this is the one we want to win.
Yeah.
It still means a lot. So they are not rallying around the flag, as you said, you know, rally around the West Indies is something slightly different. But it all means something to them because all of their countries have a different relationship. Even some of the countries that are less touched by England still have a very special relationship when it comes to, you know, St. Lucia's a really interesting one when it comes to colonization and everything else because the French are more involved. But all of these countries have this weird relationship with England and it mattered to them back in the day to be seen as respected by English players.
I mean, you speak of, those cricketers who come from different countries, but all of them had issues even in their own countries and in England with respect to racism. You hear about that story of Michael Holding in which they wouldn't let him into the swimming pool.
Yep.
I'm quite sure. That was, what, in Jamaica? And then also, if you watch Fire in Babylon, you'll see how many people actually turned up to these games who were of Caribbean heritage and they were pumped.
Yeah.
You know, it was a great time to be Caribbean or of Caribbean descent in England because that team was almost invincible and they were really, you know, doing a number on England. They had the wood against them, which continues to this day, weirdly, in a weird way.
And they had to fight. That when we talk about the colonialization of the cricket, their team was colonialized.
Yeah.
Because the white players had the captain, right? Now, they had some great white players. Don't get me wrong. I feel like, you know, we talk about Josh De Silva as this one-off. West Indies have had a lot of very good white players, especially back in those days. But the issue isn't that they had good white players. The issue is that whether they were good or not, they were the captains.
Yeah.
And so you have them fighting for it in their own side. And, you know, again, this becomes a very, very important thing. I could have done a completely different chapter on this book, also on the fact that England wouldn't allow professionals to be their captains for a long time. They literally had colonized their own team.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So every level of this, you keep coming across that thing of it's not being set up correctly.
Yeah, fair enough. And also, furthermore, down the line in this book, other teams defeat England, right? Like the Netherlands most famously defeat them in the T20 World Cup twice, is it?
Yeah, we just focused on the first one at Lords, but yeah, they beat them twice. Yeah. So the Netherlands one is, I would say it's the most fun chapter.
Yeah.
And that's partly because I got Boran, Nanis and Saylor in it and they're all funny dudes. Yeah. And one day I'd love to get them in front of a camera all telling that story.
That could be a footmark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They are, I know all three of them. They're lovely guys as well. I'd love to get them in. That is a great, great chapter, but there's so many great moments in that, including when Peter Saylor explains to us why he danced like a penguin at Lord's.
Yeah, so the Netherlands weren't colonized. In fact, they were also colonizers in different parts of the world. So they don't have that baggage with England. Neither do Afghanistan, right?
Afghanistan is really confusing because of the Durand line.
Yes.
They are actually kind of colonized by England because of that line, but they're not colonized in the way that India and New Zealand and the other countries
are. And then whilst Ireland haven't been colonized, they have a lot of bad blood with England historically.
There's the whole Northern Ireland thing.
Yeah, there's that whole thing, right?
There's the potato famine.
Yes.
There's one guy who always gets really upset when I say that England oppressed Ireland, which of course they did. Whether they did it officially under a badge or not, they made life in Ireland worse, so 100%. Life in England could be better.
Absolutely.
And also, Irish people were treated terribly in England, right?
Yeah.
So the Irish one. But then when you get to cricket, that's not the same relationship, right?
Yeah.
The relationship in cricket is that these guys, you know, I talked to Joyce. Who else did I talk to? I talked to Niall O'Brien. Oh, my God, the wicketkeeper.
Niall O'Brien.
No, the other one. Gary Wilson.
Oh, okay.
Right. So Gary Wilson's from the north. The other guys are from the Republic of Ireland. Obviously, it's two different teams that come together. Mm-hmm. But all those guys learnt their cricket in England with England players.
Yeah.
You know, they are friends with this team. Hmm. So when...
Some of them have played for England. Ed Joyce. Owen Morgan is the captain. Well, World Cup winning captain.
Exactly. So Ed Joyce is playing for Ireland in 2011. And I think the captain at that point, was it Strauss was still in the side and was captain of the England team?
Yep.
And Ed Joyce and Strauss were teammates at Middlesex. So not only did they play together for England, they'd come up together.
And they'd played the previous World Cup as teammates.
That's
2007.
What I mean. 2007, right?
Where Joyce was playing for England. So,
and Owen Morgan had played for both sides as well. So there was this. So they saw England from a cricket perspective as the big brothers, but they didn't see it as the baddies because they had got opportunities through English cricket, right? Yeah. Whereas then you come forward to, you talk about Afghanistan. Afghanistan's big brother is not England, right?
Yep.
It's Pakistan. They learn the game via Pakistan more than anyone else. Then you got Bangladesh, which obviously was colonized, but it has a relationship with India. It has a relationship with Pakistan. Mm. And then England, it's like you could almost, there's almost too much baggage before you get to England.
Yeah.
So Bangladesh don't seem to really embrace beating England the way that other teams do. Mm. I would say that the time that Bangladesh felt like they had a huge win was the first win against Australia, not against England.
The Ashraful game?
Yeah. Mm. So I think it gets more complicated the further you get into the book of how these teams see these different countries.
Yeah. And I mean, even though you've kind of explained how the Irish cricketer experience is far different from the history experience with respect to how both of those nations have clashed, right? And Afghanistan has its own complications, but of course, winning a game against Pakistan would mean a whole lot more to them, which we have seen, right? But when it comes to the Netherlands, there is none of that stuff, right? They were themselves a colonizing country or empire, and they, weirdly enough, find themselves within the fold of cricket and have defeated England. But even they recognized the importance and symbolism of defeating England in a game of cricket, having had none of that baggage compared to other countries.
Yeah, so I think that the reason it was so important to the Netherlands was that these were guys who were, outside of Dirk Nannis, these were guys, it was and Ryan Tendulskar. They were really a ragtag bunch of players, right? Amateurs, guys who never made any runs at any other level. Mm. You know, you got guys like Peter Boren, who probably definitely a first-class level player, but probably low-end first-class level player.
Yeah.
And then you had some young players coming through like Peter Saylor and everything else. But they were ragtag. This is their chance to play at Lords.
Mm.
And so for them, they weren't really beating another colonizer. They were going to Lords, and the experience was all about playing at Lords. And Saylor was the only one who didn't really know anything about it. But Boren and Nannis, they knew what Lords was. And the other Netherlands players, they couldn't believe their luck that they were going to be able to play England at Lords. Then to win.
Yeah.
And then to have the point of which there are Dutch fans there watching them, it just completely transformed that game. So their victory really I don't think they see it as a victory over England, as in, you know, the most important team in cricket. They see it as their coming out party in cricket.
Yeah.
Because it happened at Lords. It was the opening game of a World Cup. And it was a fantastic game of cricket.
Hmm.
So, again, it's a different story to what, you know, New Zealand and Sri Lanka, they're playing very specifically, you know, for national identity.
And they weren't given that opportunity for a long time, right?
No. And India and Australia, they're playing for national pride. Like, no, we are legitimate. You know, in India's case, they were called cowards, right? Mm. Like, it meant something for them to beat England. Far beyond the colonial thing, as a cricket thing, again, it meant something. Then you had the fact that footage was shown in Indian movie theatres forever.
Yeah.
Right? They played that for years to say, remember that time we beat England in a test match? Like, you have to understand the importance of cricket in Australia and India in the periods that they won it.
Yeah.
So, again, it's different.
Absolutely. And all of those great stories can be found in this book with all of that complete context. So it's definitely a must buy. I've read two chapters and I was hooked. Eek has read more than me. He's like onto his fourth chapter or something. But there's also a bit on women's cricket that you did in this book. Now, I have obviously not gotten there. But the little tagline in front of me says that you conducted a study of professionalism of women's cricket and how it is very, very different to the men's team. So just a bit on that.
Abhishek. You know, obviously, Abhishek was the co-writer on this book, and he was like, you know, how do we fit women's cricket into here? And so our first thought was, oh, we'll do the same thing with women's cricket. We'll go back. And then we thought about it. And we're like, actually, women's cricket in Australia and England kind of starts at the same time. And New Zealand isn't that far off. So there's no stage where the England women's team is similar to the England men's team. And then we took that further and we start to think, actually, if you really think about it, that sort of colonization of the sport is another reason why the England women's team isn't that important. They're never thought of as the major team. And then by the time, you know, by the 1990s, when women's cricket starts to have its first big boom, Australia's the best team.
Yeah.
And so they move on. You know, Charlotte Edwards breaks the world record and 8 minutes later, it's broken by Belinda Clark, right? Like, England can't hold on to anything at that point. And so we...
Also, women's cricket was never used as a tool.
Never, exactly. And no way was it used as a tool. And so we started looking at how the men's game had kind of allowed the women's game to be subservient to it. And how, you know, the reason it's about professionalism is because England is the first team to have professional women players twice. So in the 1800s, there was a professional women's league. And then over 100 years later, they're the first ones to make their international cricket as professional. So we're kind of, in this chapter about them, we're tracking that and how hard it was to play cricket as a women's cricketer in that era and why specifically the England women's team is not anything like the men's team. And I think that's an important thing because I think if you don't know much about cricket, you might just think it would be a similar kind of relationship. And it is not. England women's, that was elevated, but it wasn't elevated anywhere near the way the men's was.
Cricket 8 brings you this show. They are analysing every part of our game. Head over for their watch-alongs, podcasts and articles on what is really happening on the field and why it matters. Cricket8.com is your place for cricket intelligence.
I mean, prestige building is also a thing, right? Yeah. Why is Lords important? Because we are told that it's the home of cricket. It's got the museums. You have the honours boards. You create the narrative around different places and prestige building with respect to English cricket is massive.
And who didn't play at Lords?
Who didn't play at Lords?
The English women.
Yeah, there you have it.
They weren't playing at Lords. Or, you know, they virtually never played. The Middlesex women didn't play at Lords at all, right? So how do you build that prestige?
Yes.
They're playing in club grounds in the middle of nowhere. So even if you play England and you're from Pakistan or you're from Ireland or you're from the, you know, Jamaica, you know, when before the West Indies teams came together in that first World Cup, it's fine if you turn up at Edgbaston and you're playing them. There's still a little bit of, whoa, we're at Edgbaston and we're playing this team. But if you're playing them at frigging Guildford or, you know, some random place in the middle of nowhere or there's no crowd there, it's a very different situation. And, you know, women's cricket is so different to the men's game. And I wanted to talk about how it had been affected by men's cricket, not particularly in a positive way.
I feel like Lords has such a major role to play in all of this with the long room and the members and winning over there.
And women couldn't be members, of
You could write an entire book on teams winning at Lords for the first time, literally.
Could I?
You might be able to manage that. But also, do you find it a bit funny, perhaps ironic, that when it comes to being the biggest commercial hub or, you know, powerhouse in cricket, England don't really have that title anymore and that particular part of the empire has been overthrown and then some?
Yeah, I find that really interesting. I wonder where, you know, this book comes out now and let's say in the next 20 years they lose to three more teams. What would the chapters be like in 3 years' time? Where will England be? Because it's still a very rich sporting industry.
Yes.
But Australia has completely surpassed them as the most important team. And India has surpassed them as the most important team, culture, board, league, everything else. So Australia's the most winningest team, maybe is the best way of putting it. And India is the future of cricket's soul, of its capitalism, of its morals, of its everything, right? Like, you know, cricket has changed so much. So it'll be really fascinating to see where that goes. I still think there will be some teams that it'll be very important for them to beat England. But you could see in this book how it becomes less important as we go.
I mean, the future of cricket looks a lot different to the way the sport was, you know, used and played in the past, particularly by the empire, for their empire building. That is a completely, like, distant story now to where the sport is headed.
Yeah. So the front of the book has W.G. Grace on it, obviously, with his statue being pulled down.
Yes.
The back of the book has Rashid Khan. And that's not an accident. That's actually how the book is set up. And then we did it with the cover as well. Because that's where the future of cricket is going beyond the empire. And Rashid Khan is the perfect example of that. W.G. Grace, it was very hard to be a rich cricketer if you weren't English. Specifically, if you weren't a gentleman from the top echelon. But just in general, it's hard to be a rich cricketer. You can now be a rich cricketer if you're a refugee from Afghanistan. And I wanted to show how far the game had changed. But it still means something for Rashid Khan to beat England. He's not. Rashid Khan knows about this history.
Of course.
Still there. Whether it will be in 20 and 40 years' time, who knows? This might be the last time you could even write a book like this.
Maybe in 20 and 40 years, you can write a sequel, Cricket Beyond the Empire.
Oh, there we go. So I've got the Lord's book. I've got two sequels to work on now, thanks to Bayram.
Absolutely. So quickly then, just before we wrap this up, give our listeners and viewers three solid reasons to buy this book.
Look, I think this is fundamentally a book about cricket. And we have talked a lot about Empire because of the way that these teams fit in. And obviously, it's on the title. But it is a book about cricket. And what I like about this is it's a book that shows you how much cricket has evolved from the late 1800s through to Rashid Khan. You know, like the best one is probably South Africa. South Africa beat England with wrist spin.
Yes.
And then over 100 years later, Rashid Khan completely reinvents wrist spin again to beat them again.
And from Bozinke to Rashid Khan.
Exactly. And so, you know, YouTube plays a part, whereas beforehand it was posh English people teaching the South Africans how to bowl. So there's a lot of evolution here. And because of that, you do get an idea of cricket from the 1800s all the way through to 2023. So I think it's a fascinating book from that point of view. It's got some wild stories. I'm not going
to
lie.
Anecdotes are what I'm looking forward to the most.
The Pakistan chapter, it has one of my favorite stories in cricket history. We might have to do a stupid cricket just on it because of how crazy that story is. The New Zealand chapter has one about, I can't say his name because it's the longest name in cricket, but about a Fijian player that almost played for New Zealand. You know, you have these great little stories. I think there's a little subplot about Sri Lanka and Israel, how they didn't play against Israel at one time. So there's all these little fascinating stories all the way through. But it is a story about great English cricketers who need to be conquered as well. And I think that's important to remember that there are a couple of chapters where teams beat lesser England sides, whether England weren't playing their best or some of those limited oversides that weren't as great. But there's a lot of great English cricketers who are overcome here. And guys were like 40,000 first-class runs and 100 first-class hundreds and 500 wickets and all these sorts of things. And then they're losing to some guy who, you know, like Fazal Mahmood, you know, the Pakistani fast bowler who once dreamed of what it might be like, you know, to live in the UK, who then goes on to dominate the UK. The stories, the arcs of these people are just absolutely incredible.
There's the chicken farmer from Zimbabwe as well. We won't give you too much.
The chicken farmer from Zimbabwe, you know, Kevin O'Brien's story, I think is absolutely fascinating. You know, that whole game. You know, Callum McLeod from Scotland. You know, you've got someone in Callum McLeod's case who tried to make it as a county cricketer, essentially fails and then comes back as a batter later on, does okay in county cricket, and then plays one of the most miraculous innings against a World Cup team that was, against an England team that was about to win a World Cup, right? You know, the stories from Jimmy Sinclair and Aubrey Faulkner all the way through to Callum McLeod and Rashid Khan, these are cricket stories, right?
Yeah.
The empire plays a part. The colonization plays a part. The politics, the nation building are all part of it. But at the end of the day, Callum McLeod had to work out how to reverse sweep and sweep at Al-Rashid, right?
Yeah.
That's about cricket.
Yeah, and I love the fact that you've kind of woven all of those things together. You get the anecdotes. You get the holistic element of nation building, overthrowing the empire, and how the politics and all of it kind of played a part. And then you've got proper cricketing stories. Like, I've read the Australia chapter, and, you know, I think both Eke and I are maybe obsessing on Fred Spofforth ever since, because that's all cricketing stuff.
Yeah.
And I really think you guys should go buy this book. I'm going to finish it soon. And I suppose that kind of wraps up this episode of Footmark.
Yeah, people should buy this book.
We should probably give you guys a link in the, I don't know, about section or whatever.
The show notes?
Yeah, the show notes. So go purchase your copies from Amazon. And just a quick reminder to everybody, you guys can go to goodareas.co and bookmark that webpage. That can prove to be your one-stop shop for all the work that we do as part of our team, whether it be written content, podcasts, or videos. This is Eek.
Yay.
Yeah. Hello. Left-arm fast bowler, big fan of Wasim Akram. And he really wanted to be a part of this podcast as well. So yeah, go bookmark that webpage, guys, and you'll be in touch with everything that we do as part of our team. And that is it for this week. We'll be back next week for another episode of Footmarks. You guys have a good one. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly.
There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recording. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.